Sounds True presents Meditation for Beginners, Session 2, recorded in front of a live audience, Meditations on Buddhism's Four Noble Truths with Jack Kornfield.
The spirit of meditation practice or spiritual life is something that is very immediate. And what we'll do today is a variety of some stories and some teachings, four different short meditation exercises as a way, if I can, in some practical way, to give you a sense of how one works inwardly from a Buddhist perspective and a meditative perspective with the heart. The Buddha said at one point that all of the teachings of the Dharma, all of the spiritual teachings, have only one purpose, he said, and it's not good deeds or merit or concentration or insight or altered states or any of those things. None of these are the purpose for the teaching of the Buddha, but the sure heart's release, the opening, the awakening, the freedom of the heart, this is the purpose of Dharma and nothing less than that. A very wonderful kind of statement. Which means for us, if we want to enter the spiritual path, to look at our ability to awaken and to open our hearts in this life that we've been given, in this world, in this time, with its joys and its sorrows. All my work as a teacher of meditation and as a therapist, in some way, has come to me to be what I would call work of the heart. At some point, Don Juan says, look at every path closely and deliberately. Try it as many times as you think necessary. Then ask yourself and yourself alone one question. This question is one that only a very old man asks. My benefactor told me about it once when I was young, but my blood was too vigorous to understand it. But now I will tell you. Does this path have a heart? This is the question. Does this path, the way that I've chosen to live my life, does it have a heart? If it does, the path is good. If it doesn't, it's of no use. Now, how does the path with heart actually manifest as a way of living and practice? Each person has to discover, has to ask in themselves. But I'd like to share today a few of the basic principles from Buddhist teaching that may be useful to you in discovering you're living a path with heart. And they're called the Four Noble Truths, or the Four Basic Truths. They're the first thing that the Buddha taught after he was enlightened. He looked around and he said, all right, what is it that it would be useful to say to beings on this earth to come to peace, to come to awakening? The first noble truth is very simple. The first noble truth is the truth of suffering. There is suffering in the world and in life. In the world, there are wars, there is starvation, there are people sick with illnesses that we have cheap medicine for, dysentery, tuberculosis, leprosy, and so forth, and it doesn't get to them. Is there anyone who hasn't noticed that they're suffering in the world? But it's not just there, it's in our culture, and we tend to push it away. We put old people in old age homes because we don't deal with them sometimes. We put mental patients in hospitals sometimes when they don't really need it, when they could be part of our village life, but we don't want to deal with it. It's difficult. We put freeways around the ghettos. Now there are homeless people on the streets because there's no more housing money, but for a long time you didn't even have to see it. Even our corpses. Our funeral practice, we dress them up in fancy clothes, you know, and makeup like you're going to a party or a banquet. It's a dead body. In India, a dead body's a dead body, you know, and there's flowers on it. And it's honored, but it is what it is. You understand, our culture's not very good at looking at this. And so we run, and we do it personally, the suffering in our lives, our loneliness, our losses, our grief, our pain, the unfulfilled desires. Actually, George Bernard Shaw said there were two great disappointments in life. Not getting what you want and getting it, right? Yeah. All of the kinds of things like that. And we live in a culture that's addicted to speed, to drugs, to sex, to television, anything, so we don't quite feel. We become the best society members if we don't feel. It tries to put us to sleep. Because if you wake up, then you say, I don't want nuclear war and polluted water and the families breaking apart and carcinogenic food and all the rest of this. So it's actually, it's a conspiracy that we get put to sleep because nobody really wants us to wake up. So the first task is to acknowledge the fact of suffering and sorrow in our personal life and in the world. To stand on it, to stand right in the center of it, of our own death, and open ourselves to that fact. Without doing that, no healing can take place. Oscar Wilde wrote a letter when he was in prison one year for being a homosexual. He was imprisoned. And the letter said, the trouble with prisons is not that they break hearts. Hearts are meant to be broken, but like their own walls, turn the hearts of those within to stone. If you've ever done prison work, you know that. It hardens people. But it's an amazing line. Hearts are meant to be broken. There's a lot of wisdom in that. I remember going with my teacher, Ajahn Chah. We were driven to a monastery near the Cambodian border one time. And drivers in Asia are generally even worse than Boston drivers. I mean, it's really nutty on the highways. And we were going on this kind of lane and a half narrow road to a temple on the Cambodian border with a driver who was zooming around ox carts and buses without seeing what was ahead. It was really quite terrifying, and I'm sitting there trying to meditate and thinking, well, I guess I'll just die a monk, you know, this is how it's going to be, and trying to breathe and be aware. And then I looked over at Ajahn Chah, and I saw that his hands were also kind of really gripping the seat, and his knuckles were white. And we got there, finally. We arrived at this temple, and he turned to me, and he said, that was scary, wasn't it? And I went, oh, thank you. It was just this very simple acknowledgement that that was what was so. It wasn't pretending anything, and it wasn't wrong that it was scary. And I think he would be fine to die. But it's just that to face the things that are actually human in us. The spirituality really has to do more with our humanness than with anything extraordinary. Now, if we want to do this, the very first step is simply to be here. The first step of meditation, also the last one, fortunately, to be here. You've heard Be Here Now. There was a cartoon in the San Francisco Chronicle this fall that had a man walking down the street with a placard on it that said, Jesus is coming. And there was a little man following him behind with another placard on that said, Buddha here now. Now, I believe, if you understand it right, that Jesus is also here now, if we understand it. But the point is not to leave. You've heard of out-of-the-body experiences. What we're looking for is something more difficult called an in-the-body experience, right? So this first meditation is simply the meditation of stopping our movement, not running away from our boredom or our loneliness or our fear or all the things that we ourselves have run from or been in conflict with. And just coming here and sensing what is true and also feeling what it is that we haven't touched with our awareness in our heart, what asks for our attention and our healing. So let your eyes close gently. Find some way to sit. We'll sit for maybe 10 minutes or so. Where your back is reasonably straight, so your breath is easy. Your feet are on the floor or you're stable. And first just come into the body and be here. There'll be some sounds of my words or various thoughts that pass through. Let those be like waves of the ocean. Let them just come and go. And just come back to be with your body and be with the movement of your breath first, just for the first 2 or 3 minutes of this. your life breath. If you were underwater, it would really matter to you. Feel it in that way, this next breath. Sitting quite centered and open, like a queen or a king on a throne. Opening just to this moment, just coming back. Let's begin to open the attention and to feel or sense those places in our being that ask for healing and understanding the sorrows or conflict we've run from. First in the body. Feel your body with full awareness and kindness and notice the places of tension. Or holding. Notice the places that are sick or the places that are wounded. And let your awareness open very gently and kindly to include, to connect. What are the places of sorrow in our body that we've left or lost touch with, that we haven't listened to? Simply opening to this truth, to what is here. Now feel your heart and your feelings, that which has held the barriers and the sorrows there, the losses that we've suffered, the unfinished business. The fears. The things that have hurt us. That we still carry. And with a gentle attention, let them show themselves. These are the sorrows of our heart, to be healed or understood. First, just to notice them, receive them. Be aware of the places of the mind now that are our wounds, the places of conflict, our ideals, our dreams, how we wanted it to be, the disappointments. And let those too come into awareness. And then beyond ourselves, let come into your awareness some of the sorrows of the earth that we've avoided and neglected, that we haven't let ourselves really see, but we know is true. Let yourself see with a very gentle and open awareness, just to see what is true. Now come back for one more moment to the breath to center yourself, having seen these. Sit. center yourself in this moment. There's a way in which we all deeply long to do the work of the heart, but we forget. We get so busy, we might be too caught up in someone else's difficulties, or we just get so busy that we forget to ask, what is it in this body, in this heart, in this mind, at this time, that really is asking for attention? The first noble truth is that there is suffering, that it's inevitable in life. There's aging and there's death and there's loss. And it takes a lot of courage to discover how to work with it. Yet in some way the thing that we most long for is to come to a place that can face everything, that can be free in every circumstances, which is really the same word as to love. If you want to learn how to love, that's what's required. This is from Pope John the 23rd. It often happens that I wake at night and begin to think about a serious problem and decide I must tell the Pope about it. Then I wake up completely and I remember I am the Pope. This is really what meditation is about. It's to begin to face the things that we and everybody else has run away from and discover that we have this capacity, like the Buddha, to sit and to see these things. The second noble truth, let's continue. The first is that there's suffering. The Buddha didn't start with happiness and joy and enlightenment and so forth because that would make an ideal. I want to get there. He said, all right, let's start with where we are. Let's be very practical about this. Second noble truth is the cause. What's the cause of suffering? Our reactions to it, our aversion, our hatred, our greed, our fear, our jealousy, worldwide and personally. What makes all the wars and starvation? Greed. Not just desire. Greed. Insatiable, deep greed. Fear. Hatred. Delusion, prejudice, aversion. There's enough food. There's enough oil. There's enough energy. There is. We don't need more resources. We need less greed and hatred and delusion and more love. That's the source of it. Do you know that there have been 105 revolutions or wars since World War II? And there are only 155 or 60 countries? Not a good track record as a species. It's really sad. The source of it worldwide is the same as the source in our personal lives. What's the source of our suffering? Our greed and our attachment and our fear and our reactiveness and our jealousy. My teacher Ajahn Chah used to wander around the monastery, especially when people were having a hard time. He would kind of come up to people, and walk up slowly with his cane, and if you look like you're having a hard time, he'd come over and he'd say, are you suffering today? And you might say no, in which he'd say, fine, have a good day, enjoy yourself, you know. Or if you said yes, then he would say, oh, must be very attached, and then he would walk off, you know. It's that simple. It's like direct wire. And when the light on the dashboard reads suffering, it means just one thing. Guess what? It's that basic. But what we have done by our conditioning from very early and what our culture teaches us is that we have touched the wounds and the pain and the difficulties with aversion and fear. We've pushed them away. We've run away from them. And we've touched the pleasure that comes. Our automatic habitual reaction is that we touch that and we say, oh, I want more, and we grasp. And so we spend our life tottering back and forth between trying to run away from and avoid pain and suffering. Anybody been able to do that? I'd like to meet you. or to grasp and have only pleasure stay and have something stay. Have anything stay. Have you found anything that stays? A single thing. A moment, even. And so we go back and forth. And we are at war, mostly with ourselves and with what is. If you want to heal other people, this is the healing to start with. Now, there is another way. And we all know this. I mean, what I'm telling you, probably half the people in the room could sit up here and tell us the same thing. So we're just kind of reminding ourselves, yes, don't forget, you know, don't run away today. Oh, thank you. I appreciate your opinion. Yes. It's that simple. It's really very basic. At the same time, it's really hard. I've spent years in meditation, in therapy, in body work, doing service work of different kinds. And I still see how powerful is the habit of fear and aversion and running away in certain ways. It takes real love and devotion to do it. But if we want to do it, if we want to do this healing work, we have to discover or find that courage to let go. And that courage really means that we have to be certain of our capacity to love, that we really can do it. Mostly in my work these days, I used to see a lot of greed and anger and desire and all kinds of neurotic things. That's what I used to look at. Mostly in my work these days, I only see one thing. I see fear. That's really what's at the bottom of everything I see. People are afraid. Afraid to feel, afraid to be here, afraid to open in some way. So do we have that capacity? We create our sense of self out of ideas. There is a different reality, and it's not there through some fantastic altered state spiritual hoobly-gooble. It's really a very practical and immediate reality. There is a capacity that we have of our being, of our hearts. It's called the greatness of heart that we can discover that can live from a place of openness. We can really do it. This is Martin Luther King. And, I mean, he had real great difficulties. This was in the middle of the difficult, people were being bombed and killed and whatever. He said, "We will match your capacity to inflict suffering with our capacity to endure suffering. We will meet your physical force with soul force. We will not hate you, but we cannot in all good conscience obey your unjust laws. But we will soon wear you down by our capacity to suffer. And in winning our freedom, we will so appeal to your heart and conscience that we will win yours in the process." Isn't that a line? We will soon wear you down by our capacity to suffer. He's somebody who stood on his death. He stood right in the center of death and suffering, and said there's a greater reality than this. To do this, to see all of the things that we've struggled with, and instead come to a place of letting go, requires a very deep forgiveness. That's really what's asked of us. Forgiveness doesn't mean you condone it. If somebody rapes somebody or murders or something, you don't say, "Well, I forgive you, that's terrific that you did it." It doesn't condone at all. You might take very strong action and say, "That's terrible. That must never happen again. We will do what's necessary to ensure it." And forgiveness is there anyway. And in the end, one finds forgiveness. Why should one forgive? Because the person that you don't forgive, you know, is off having a vacation in Hawaii, you know, and you're here not forgiving, and who's suffering? That's one reason why. Because who does it help or harm? Secondly, the third Zen patriarch said, if you want to awaken into the Tao, the way of enlightenment, you must be without anxiety about non-perfection. It's not perfect. It never has been, and it never will be. Or as Elizabeth Kubler-Ross puts it, "I'm not okay and you're not okay, and that's okay." Right? Forgiveness means that life is the way it is rather than the way we wanted it to be. And that doesn't mean that we can't offer our love and service to create beauty in it, but it is the way that it is. We look for perfection in the wrong place. There's only one place to find perfection, I promise you. Half of meditation practice is simply self-acceptance. I mean, I do retreats, 3-month retreats for 100 people. Do you know what people do for a lot of that 3 months? Self-acceptance. And they don't want to do it. I'll accept this much, but not. Forgiveness. Does this make sense to you? And without that, how can you love another person? A poem from my friend Ed Brown, and then we'll do our next meditation, okay? He's a Zen teacher and a cook. He wrote the Tassajara bread book and the Tassajara cookbook and so forth. He says, and still we cook. At any moment preparing this meal, we could be gas 30,000 feet in the air, soon to fall out poisonous on leaf, frond, and fur, everything in sight, obliterated, deceased. And still we cook, putting 1,000 cherished dreams on the table to nourish and reassure those close and dear. In this act of cooking, I bid farewell. Always I insisted you alone were to blame. This last instant, my eyes open, and I regard you with all the tenderness and forgiveness I withheld for so long. With no future, we have nothing to fight about. May all beings be happy. This last instant, my eyes open, and I regard you with all the tenderness and forgiveness I withheld for so long. Don Juan says to Carlos Castaneda, the trouble with you is you think you have time. It's really an extraordinary line. You think, I'll do it tomorrow, next year. To awaken is to do it when? Is to do it now. So again, make yourself comfortable. Please. The second noble truth, the cause of our suffering, is our fighting and struggling with what is. So, let your eyes close again gently and come back to the breath. Just come into your body. Feel the movement of the breath like a breeze. It breathes itself. Your whole being is in change like a river. The breath shows you that river, that movement of impermanence. Let your breath be soft and easy without controlling. Let your attention be soft to feel the littlest movement that the breath makes. Now in this place of quieting, we'll do a traditional meditation on forgiveness, a practice. And because it's a practice, it may or may not work for you. It's something one works with over time. Feeling the breath and the body, the heart, letting the breath be soft and the heart be soft. First, asking forgiveness. If I have hurt or harmed anyone in thought or word or deed, knowingly or unknowingly, and I have done so, in the ways that I have, I allow these instances to come into my mind and heart and ask forgiveness. We only act unskillfully for two reasons, out of our own pain and out of our fear. We don't know. We get confused, and in our pain and fear, we hurt other people. May I be forgiven. Now toward yourself, because we've been so hard on ourselves. To do forgiveness is to soften the barriers around our heart, to let ourselves into our hearts. In the ways that I have hurt or harmed myself, this body and heart and mind, in all the ways, out of my fear and pain and ignorance, out of neglect or dishonesty, so many ways I've not cared for you, my sweet self. May I be forgiven. I ask and extend forgiveness. And let come to mind, into your awareness, the images of that which asks for forgiveness, those times and actions. Let your heart be as soft as it can. You deserve to be forgiven. It's only that which lets you open. And then lastly, the wounds and sorrow we have suffered at the hands of others. All of these that we've touched with such hardness and aggression and resentment, hardened ourselves. You who have hurt or harmed me, knowingly or unknowingly, in thought or word or deed, we've been wounded and hurt by many. Out of their fear and their pain and confusion. To the extent that I can at this time, I extend you forgiveness. Feel the places that you hold, the resentment, the business from the past, and touch them with kindness and forgiveness, and see if it's not time to let go. Is it in this life, in ourselves and others, in the world around us, that most asks our forgiveness? And our mercy, and the love of our heart. Let us extend that. Now, it's important to understand that forgiveness is a work. It's not an act of will. And sometimes you have to grieve for a year or two, or rage, or be angry, or all kinds of things are part of the process of letting go. So you can't paper it over or pretend it. But what one needs to do in doing the work first is to feel that which needs to be done, and to see how we hold it with our awareness and with our heart, And that begins to give us a sense of what it means to open, what needs to be opened. You might do the forgiveness meditation and not much happens. But if you do it every day for half an hour, for 10 days, or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, all of a sudden all these subtle things that we hold, I've never forgave that, this person and that, or mostly in ourselves, all the ideals that we have. And without seeing those, we're always caught in the cycle of judgment. So it's really a deep work, and we're just kind of tasting the flavor of how one might work with that. The second noble truth, the cause of suffering, our human suffering, is our fighting with what is. Very simple. Our attachment, our reactions, our fear, our greed, our complications. And to the extent that we're attached, to that extent do we suffer. Try it. See how much you're attached to your body. You know, look in the mirror as it grows old. It does, you know, right? And it gets grayer and it wrinkles and stuff. The extent to which you are attached to it, that equals how much suffering you'll have. Doesn't mean that you don't care for it. It's beautiful. It's fantastic to have a body. See and eat and move and make love and all these things. But to the extent that you grasp things, it creates suffering. So the third noble truth is the end of suffering, nirvana. It's very, very simple. The end of suffering is about letting go. Doesn't mean not living or not being present. People confuse letting go with leaving the world. That's the opposite. That's called running away or fear. Right? Letting go means letting go into each moment, into this next moment, so that we are here with things as they are. So the third noble truth is letting go and stop going in circles and coming to rest in the reality of the present. This is from Kabir, the ancient Indian poet. He says, "Friend, please tell me what I can do about this world I hold on to and keep spinning out, samsara. I gave up sewn clothes and wore a robe, but one day I noticed how well woven was its cloth. So I bought some burlap, but I still throw it elegantly over my left shoulder. I pulled back my sexual longings, and now I discover that I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, and now I notice that I'm greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I'm proud of myself. When the mind wants to break its links to the world, it still holds on to something. Kabir says, listen, my friend, there are very few that find the path, yet it is right here in front of us." So this is the third noble truth, which basically acknowledges that we don't own things. We are not the owners. We don't own our children, thank God. You know? I mean, if you try to possess your children, it makes them crazy and sick, and you as well. We don't own our work. We don't own the earth. You know, you have a title, this is my half acre. It's not yours. We don't own our minds. I'm sure you've noticed that. I mean, there. The mind, when you learn to meditate, after a while, you begin to see that the mind has no pride at all. It will do anything. Right? And you don't own your bodies. I mean, we're just given this. It's like Avis, Hertz. You rent it for a while, and you take care of it. You know, you want to return it in decent condition, or more or less. It kind of deteriorates. But because you got to take it around places with you. But you don't own it. It's really true, we own nothing. We're like accountants in the firm, it says. You know? We're entrusted with a body, with a heart, with the capacity to feel. And so the third noble truth is that of letting go. It's of another possibility, not of accumulating and grasping. Because at the end of your life, especially if you have the privilege to be with someone who's dying, who's done some spiritual work, the questions that we ask are really very simple ones. It's not, you know, what did I build and make and write and do and so forth when you look back. But did I love well is one of those questions. Did I really let myself love the people around me and the family and community and the earth? That's what matters. Or did I learn to live fully moment to moment? Another way to say that is, did I learn to let go? Because if you haven't learned to let go by that point, then you have what is called a crash course, you know. But it's said to die before death, to do it now so that you can live from that place of awakening. The third noble truth, the possibility of balance in the midst of the changing 10,000 joys and sorrows. Now, there's a wonderful illustration of meditation that I saw on a poster one day of Swami Satchitananda. He's a Hindu guru with a long gray beard and flowing hair, and he's a wonderful teacher, actually. Teaches yoga and meditation. Anyway, he was standing in a little orange loincloth in some variation of the tree pose, only he was balanced on a surfboard on a really big wave like that. It was impressive, I'll tell you, this big picture of him. And underneath it said, "You can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf." Meditate with Swami Satchitananda or something like that, kind of a. And that really captured the spirit of meditation in the picture. It was wonderful. It's not that you sit and you're supposed to have some particular thing happen. It all happens. And often when you sit, what you get first is what you've run away from. To sit is to look in the mirror, to meditate, to do spiritual life, is to stop. And then all the things that we say, well, I don't want to feel this and look at that and so forth, they're what we get first. I call it the Freudian layer, right? That's the first stuff. But you sit and you find that balance and you discover that there is another possibility, which is to open in the midst of all of that. The Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree and he didn't say no to anything. He sat there and he didn't make some philosophical argument and he didn't try to convince anyone of anything. He didn't refute anything. He just sat there and said no to nothing. He didn't say no to anything. And so he became free. Zen Master Suzuki Roshi in San Francisco, when he was dying of cancer, he called his students together. Most moving passage in his book for me. And he said, "If when I die, if I suffer, that's all right, you know. That's just suffering, Buddha. No confusion in it. Maybe everyone will suffer because of the physical agony or the spiritual agony, but that's all right. You should be grateful to have a limited body like mine or like yours. If you had a limitless life, it would be a real problem for you." But what a phrase. If when I die, if I suffer, that's all right, you know. That's just suffering, Buddha. Sun Buddha, moon Buddha, happy Buddha, sad Buddha, joyful Buddha, suffering Buddha. This is the end of suffering, which is to say there's pain, but there isn't that conflict. It's the end of conflict. It's really simple. Spiritual life is not a complicated thing. It's very, very, to let go is a very simple thing. So let's do our next meditation. This is a meditation which comes from the Theravada Buddhist tradition, and it's a recommended meditation for the time near death. It's simple. It will only be 2 minutes or 5 minutes, very short. But it's taught that the state of consciousness, the state of the heart at the time of death is very important in determining the adventures that follow. Now, you don't have to believe in that stuff. It's true, but you don't have to believe it, right? But the other thing to understand is that we die all the time. Every morning we wake up and we're reborn. Every time we meet a new person, we're reborn. So it's always a death and rebirth. So this is a meditation of preparing oneself for death in a certain way. Let your eyes close. And it's said to create a skillful state of consciousness is very helpful in this preparation. So first again, come back to your breath. Just center yourself. And now as you feel your breathing, letting it be natural, get a sense of your mortality, that this breath which sustains your life, you could live another 50 years, or 20, or one more day, you don't know. But someday this breath will stop, and the heart will stop, and that will be it for this body. it's really true. Stand on your death. And from knowing this, one wonders, how then shall I live? Now the meditation at this point, as you sit and feel that reality of death someday, is to look back over your life and bring to mind, remember or picture or sense in some way, two good deeds of your life that you have done, two things that were good that you did in your life. Notice what state of consciousness comes as you do that, also how it affects the heart and mind to see those deeds. Mother Teresa says, we cannot do great things in life. We can only do small things with great love. And that the things that matter when you look back, you may have lots on your resume, were picking the flowers for someone, or giving the parking space, or being there when someone was dying, or putting your life and your energy into something that you cared about, even if you didn't know if it was right, but it seemed the right thing to do, whether it was a piece of a political action or some other circumstance with a person in difficulty that you spoke the truth out of caring for them. Very, very simple acts. Can you feel the flavor of that? So that what the Buddha discovered was a way of living and a realization that wasn't complicated, and it wasn't someplace else, but it was of a really resting on the ground of this moment and living in that way. In some way, meditation practice is really about intimacy. You know, people say, well, how does spiritual life and relationship fit together? They're the same thing. To meditate properly is to become intimate with your breath and your body and your heart and feelings. It's to open your senses so that you're intimate with what's here, your life and your death. And that's what brings our fulfillment and our freedom. When I did this, I thought about one client that I work with who was a kind of depressed, middle-aged woman who lived in some town, some distance from where I was, but she wanted to come see me. She'd met me, so forth. And she was really unhappy, and she worked for some kind of bureaucratic office in the government and did nothing, although she'd had a Ivy League education, but she'd had this great trauma and disappointment in her life where she'd gotten involved and pregnant by this man, and it's this great movement, and then the movement collapsed and the baby was stillborn both at the same time, and that was 20 years before, and she never really recovered from it, and she just thought so terrible of herself. Her self-esteem was down really at the bottom of the scale. And for some reason, this person touched me. I don't know why, this woman, but I just felt connected with her. And she came for 2 years. We worked together. And mostly, I just loved her. And she would tell me all these things that she thought bad about herself, and I just couldn't see them. And I would sit there, and I would listen, and kind of we'd talk about it. But mostly, I just loved her. And then finally, after a couple of years, we terminated, and she went and she worked with some woman that was much closer in her area. It was enough driving and so forth. I don't even know if I helped her much. I hope so. But it was just such a privilege to be able to love somebody like that. Really simple. Now, the fourth noble truth, the first is that there is suffering. The second is its cause, which is our attachment and greed and so forth. The third is the end of suffering, nirvana. I mean, it has many levels of meaning. It goes very, very deep. We're just beginning today. Nirvana also means the unconditioned, that beyond all that we possess or own or grasp. And coming to that, which is not someplace else, but it's actually to be found here. So that then you can say, as Suzuki Roshi said, if when I die I suffer, that's all right, you know. That's just suffering, Buddha. The fourth noble truth is the path to the end of suffering. It's also called the Eightfold Path, and it has right speech and right action and right livelihood, virtue and meditation, all those things which there isn't time to work with today. But the ground of the path is the understandings we've talked about, that there's suffering, but that there is another way, that we can sense in ourselves some other potential for much greater compassion or greater love or greater wisdom in this life. And that in order to awaken that, it doesn't happen by accident. It follows the law of karma, which is nothing mystical about lamas in Tibet and all of those things. The law of karma means, as one Vipassana teacher, Ruth Dennison, who's a friend of mine, said, somebody asked her, explain karma really simply. She said, karma means you don't get away with nothing. That how we think and how we react creates what our world will be, our response. So that spiritual life doesn't just come down, okay, now I'll be a spiritual person, because these are great ideas. It comes by our planting the seeds in our heart and experience. It takes cultivation, the cultivation of our inner garden. So that if we practice aversion and irritation and hatred and judgment and so forth, after a while it becomes really easy, and in a situation, that's our response. If, on the other hand, we plant the seeds consciously, we practice opening or compassion or peacefulness or wakefulness or that intimacy that I spoke of, then in situations easy or difficult, through the nourishment of that, that becomes our way. And we awaken, we uncover, we manifest as our Buddha nature. Now, if you want a simplified version of the Eightfold Path, it has, you know, all these steps, and the ground of it, in some ways, is also virtue, that you don't harm other people, not through speech, through your words, to say what is true and also what is helpful or kind. That's the principle. Not through killing or stealing. And it's very hard to meditate after a day of lying and stealing. You know, try it. They're really connected. Who we are, that's what our spiritual life is. And meditation is called practice. It's not called perfect, right? It's a place that you practice so that then you can live it. Sexuality and drugs are included. Very good things for our times. We can create a lot of suffering through sexuality. It's a neutral energy that can be associated with greed and compulsion and exploitation, or can be associated with caring and communion and love and intimacy. What do we do with that energy? Because it's powerful, you know. To act in ways consciously that don't bring harm to a second or third person through our sexuality out of our greed. But to use that as a force for awakening, to use our words, our actions. How many people in this room have made idiots of themselves around sexuality? Don't raise your hand. There's no need. Right? We know already. I mean, this is powerful stuff. So it says, take your speech, your sexuality, intoxicants. The Buddha knew what was going on, and he didn't even live in California. Right? Intoxicants. Refrain from drugs, alcohol, and other addictive substances to the point where they lead you in any way to loss of awareness or lead you to any heedlessness or action that's unskillful. Some people interpret it as just stay away from it, which for some people is quite necessary. But the basic principle is if they cause carelessness, there are 10 million drug addicts, 20 million alcoholics, 50 million alcoholic people in alcoholic families in our culture, not to speak of other addictions and the suffering. So it's to respect alcohol, drugs, our speech. How we live is our spiritual life. Ajahn Chah, my teacher, said, do you want an Eightfold Path in a simple version? I'll give it to you. The Eightfold Path is two eyes, two ears, two nostrils, a tongue and a body, and that which walks the path is the heart or the mind. It's what we see and hear and taste and touch. That is actually the path. And then the work of the heart of the Eightfold Path, or the middle path, is to find a letting go, a wisdom, a balance in all things, and to touch it with compassion. It does not mean withdrawal from the world. There's something called the near enemies in Buddhist psychology. The near enemy to equanimity is indifference. It masquerades as that. The near enemy to love is attachment. You may have noticed sometimes. There's all this love, and then this other thing sneaks in after a while that wants that person to be just this way and never change. The near enemy to compassion is pity. Oh, that poor person, they're suffering, as if they were different. It separates us. Attachment separates us. You're out there and I need you. Indifference, the near enemy to equanimity, says, I'm fine by myself and the rest doesn't matter. I mean, it's all impermanent anyway. If this marriage doesn't work, I'll try another, or that job doesn't work. I could always have more kids anyway. It's kind of that hippie or whatever, you know. It's all one and it all doesn't matter. And that's not spirituality. That's running away. It's fear. Equanimity means the capacity of our being and heart to enter into or open in the midst of life. It's not getting somewhere, but it's an opening. And that requires courage, and it requires finding our capacity to love. From Chief Seattle, this we know, when he gave all his tribal lands to the government, when he was forced to. All things are connected. Like the blood which unites one family, all things are connected, and whatever befalls the earth befalls the children of the earth. People did not weave the web of life. We are merely a strand in it. And whatever we do to the web, we do to ourselves. So you don't even do it for anybody else. You really do it so that when you look back at the end of your life and you say, what good did I do? What touched my heart? That it's there for you. I'll tell you a story before we do our last meditation. I was traveling in India with my wife about 8 years ago or so on one trip. And we were in the desert in Rajasthan. We were up in Mount Abu visiting a wonderful teacher named Vimla Thakkar, a wonderful woman who does the work of Gandhi and also teaches meditation, combines village development and very deep inner meditation. And my wife started having these painful visions of dying and death and so forth, which sometimes come in meditation. That's kind of what I interpreted them as. But it was still quite difficult. One night she had this vision of this person that she thought she knew very well, who was dying, was throwing up this orange substance. And it was really scary, frightening, and woke her up. And then the next short time afterward, she had a vision. She has these two Native American spirit guides that come just once in a while and in really important moments in her life. And this vision came again, only there were three. There were those two guides, and there was a third one, and it was her brother. Very strange. Well, a week later, given the time lag and the way things are in India, it's a very sad story, actually, we received a telegram, and the telegram said, your brother Paul has died of suicide. And he had a family with three children, so it was really very sad. Situation. He was an alcoholic, and he'd actually started to dry out. He'd started AA, and as he started to come back into consciousness, as often happens, the first year is the very hardest, he began to see the havoc and the pain and the damage that he hadn't faced and that he'd caused and that it was a part of his life. And it was just too much for him. He didn't have the help and the resources to face that. And it said, this telegram was mailed on a particular day. It said, your brother Paul died last night. Well, we looked at the date of that telegram, and as you can imagine in the story, it was the night that she had the vision of this person throwing up this orange stuff, and then the vision of her brother as a spirit guide where he was fine. And then she had to come back and go to the funeral and so forth. But the interesting thing for this moment in the story is that here we were literally as far away on the earth as you could be from California. We were halfway around the world on top of some mountain. How is it that she knew that her brother had died the night that he died? And that you've heard this story from other people. If you search for the awakened heart, says Chogyam Trungpa, if you put your hand through your rib cage and feel for it, there's nothing there except for tenderness. You feel sore and soft, and if you open your eyes to the rest of the world, you feel tremendous sadness. This kind of sadness doesn't come from being mistreated. You don't feel sad because someone has insulted you or because you feel impoverished. Rather, this experience of sadness is unconditioned. It occurs because your heart is completely exposed. There's no skin or tissue covering it. It is like pure raw meat. Even if a tiny mosquito lands on it, you feel so touched. For the spiritual journey, this experience of the sad and tender heart is what gives birth to real fearlessness, to the capacity to live in the world with the heart and compassion of a Buddha. Real fearlessness is the product of our tenderness. It comes from letting the world tickle your heart, your raw and beautiful heart, and discovering that all is connected with it. So the work that we do in ourselves is the work that we do for someone else. It's the same work. Now, the art of meditation is to turn your difficulties into the path. It's not that your difficulties are obstacles to get over so that then you can be spiritual. Forget it. You know, when things are groovy, it's fine to be spiritual. Yeah, it's very easy, peaceful, very fine. It's in the difficulties that the heart becomes liberated and awakened. It's in those very places. That's what alchemy is about. Lead to gold. And that is the capacity of us as humans. So let's do this last meditation that may illustrate this for you. The path to awakening, turning difficulties into our freedom. Let your eyes close gently. Come back again to your breath. Just feel yourself sitting here quietly. And now imagine that instead of sitting here, a bit of time passes. Picture, feel, sense, imagine, whatever way you can. And it's time for you to discover or face one of your great difficulties. It might be the greatest difficulty at work, or a great difficulty you have in your personal life. But let yourself picture, sense, feel, in some way imagine that you're there. And get into it. You know, what room are you in? Or who are you with? What does it feel like to be there? What's your body feel like? What lesson do you have to learn in seeing it anew from this perspective? Now let the difficulty really arise and become full-blown, this difficult person or situation. See what you do, how you get caught in it, and they get caught in it. Just notice it. Be aware of what your body feels like. Let it reach its peak, as bad as it gets. And now there's a knock at the door, or the doorbell rings, or even if you're outside, someone comes to see you, say, excuse me a minute, I just have to take a minute out, and leave the situation. And when you go to the door or to see who's coming, it will either be the Buddha or the goddess of infinite compassion, Kuan Yin, the goddess of mercy. And they come up, and they say, having a hard day? And you kind of nod. And they say, let me help you. And they ask if they could switch clothes with you. They take your clothes and your body. You get to be invisible, and they dress in your body and your clothes. And they say, now let us go back. And they're going to show you how they would do it, how the Buddha or the Goddess of Mercy would do it in your place. So let yourself imagine or sense or follow them back right in that situation and see how they handle it. What does their body feel like? What do they say, or how are they silent in that situation? Let them finish it up, and then for a moment, and then say, excuse me, and again, go back to the door where you met them. And they give you your body back and your clothes. And before they leave you, they reach under their robes and they have a little present for you to remind you of how to do this, a little gift, a clear symbol. So take this gift from them and see what it is and what it means to you. Let yourself know it in some way or other. And let them then reach over and touch your body in some place that asks for loving healing. And whisper in your ears a few words of advice. Just a few words you'll hear them say. Remember this. And then you take the gift and the advice and bow to them and let go and come back to this room. Now, my question for you is, where did this Buddha or goddess come from? Huh? Where does this person reside? Very interesting. Very interesting. I've given you just some hints of how one can practice. You need to do a 10-day retreat and 10 years of meditation practice and 5 years of therapy and 20 years of compassionate service to others and make it a spiral, because it's not a particular thing. It's your life that we're talking about. And there is no McMeditation. You don't drive in, kind of get dispensed. In a way, it's not a good service. I gave it to you a little bit packaged. It's a little too glossy, and it's really not the real thing. You need to sit and feel your boredom and your loneliness and the things that are true in your life, and work with the nitty-gritty of it. And for that, you need a teacher or a practice or some way that you choose. Pick it. Pick a path with heart and understand that it's the only thing that really matters.
This concludes Meditation for Beginners with Jack Kornfield. Music by Nwang Kechog from Sounds of Peace, available through Sounds True. Thank you for listening.